morning. This is AM. I'm Michael Brissenden. United Nations climate talks enter their final stretch in Paris this week, with countries working to draw up a new global agreement to prevent global warming from exceeding 2 degrees. The Foreign Affairs Minister Julie Bishop is now leading the Australian delegation and updated the conference on the government's newly announced innovation strategy. The minister says there's still plenty of work to do, but she's confident a global agreement can be reached.
Mr. President, we've seen an unprecedented display of collective commitment and ambition this year. Around 185 countries have submitted post-2020 targets, many quantifiable, many unconditional. Experts tell us this has been a significant step forward. We're also well aware this will not yet be enough to stay well below the 2-degree goal. 5 yearly reviews of targets will allow countries to build on their efforts as technology develops and capacity grows. A new agreement must harness this collective momentum and promote further ambition and action by all countries over time. Through improved transparency, we should have confidence that other countries are meeting their targets and will drive further efforts to meet our shared goal. We need a strategy to build ambition and action over time. We will be successful in delivering a global agreement if we work together. The world is watching and demands nothing less.
The Foreign Affairs Minister, Julie Bishop. Well, on the sidelines, an international collaboration of scientists has released an annual tally of greenhouse gas emissions. For the first time, they say emissions have stalled while economic growth continued. It's a glimmer of good news, but experts are cautioning against celebration just yet. ABC Environment reporter Sarah Phillips reports.
The Global Carbon Project has been tracking greenhouse gas emissions for more than a decade. In that time, it's seen nothing but growth. That is, until 2014, when emissions were basically flat. And the numbers for 2015 show that emissions may actually be falling by around 0.5%. Pep Canadel is the executive director of the Global Carbon Project.
It's extraordinary of these past 2 years is that the slowdown has happened along with a robust growth of the global economy, with the GDP growing well over 3%.
So were you surprised by what you found?
Oh, absolutely. What we found these past 2 years have not really been observed before, nor we were expecting so suddenly to see this plateauing.
The tension between maintaining economic growth and preventing climate change from becoming worse has long dogged climate policies. Dr. Canadel believes it's too early to say whether the world has overcome the challenge.
I think that we'll see emissions resuming in the very near future. What I think that is that we may be moving away from the very fast growth in emissions that we've seen over the past 15 years to a slower growth on global emissions.
John Connor from the Climate Institute says the research confirms what their own work has found.
All the studies show that we can have continued economic prosperity and declining and ultimately zero emissions. By 2050, we can be at zero emissions and still have grown our GDP some 150%.
Dr. Canadel says the world still has a tough task ahead of it.
The total budget that we have from the beginning of the Industrial Revolution for 2 degrees is about 3 trillion tons of CO2. The bad news of this is that more than two-thirds of this budget has been already consumed. The budget that is still left is being consumed about 40 billion tons per year, which means that in less than 30 years, we'll have consumed all this budget. And at that point, if we still want to be under 2 degrees, we would have to be not emitting any emissions into the atmosphere.
He's doubtful we will achieve our climate goal unless countries step up their ambition at the Paris climate talks this week.
And unless something happens in terms of ambition, it's likely that we're going to go beyond 2 degrees.
Executive Director of the Global Carbon Project, Pep Canadel, ending that report by Sarah Phillips. There are hopes that renewable energy products will be one of the areas that will see a boost in investment from the government's $1 billion innovation package. The Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, says he wants to start an ideas boom to transform Australia's economy away from mining. The investment sector has welcomed the package, saying it provides a policy framework needed for people to invest in the clean energy sector. But some say the government needs to change its positions on renewable energy and climate change for the industry to truly thrive. Michael Edwards reports.
Reposit is a small Canberra-based startup that has big plans to change the way electricity is bought and sold in Australia.
What we do is take customers who have solar panels and batteries and allow them to participate in wholesale markets, which have traditionally been accessed only by big energy companies and dirty power generators.
That's Luke Osborne, a director of the company. He says Reposit has breakthrough technology and has received funding from both the public and private sector, but he says he knows how tough it can be for innovation-based companies to attract investment dollars.
For most companies, it's very, very difficult. There's an aversion to putting money into high-risk ventures. I think that is bad for our economy because we tend to put our money into things that we know well, like mining ventures and so forth.
The renewable energy sector is looking forward to that changing with the government's $1.1 billion innovation package. The Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, wants the money to drive research and help the economy transition away from the mining boom. Early stage investors in startup businesses will get a 20% non-refundable tax offset and a capital gains tax exemption. Yasser El Ansari from the Australian Private Equity and Venture Capital Association says the package should provide certainty for investors looking to put their money into clean energy projects.
What's been holding back institutional investors for a long time now is the uncertainty which exists around this clean tech, renewable energy part of our economy. What we're asking institutional investors to do at the end of the day is make a decision to invest their capital for periods of 5, 10 or even 15 years. What they need is certainty that the policy architecture, the rules of the game aren't going to change every year or two, which is going to create problems for the investment decisions that they've made for the long term.
But environmentalists say there are still massive hurdles in the way of renewable energy innovation. John Connor is from the Climate Institute.
Well, we've got a big belching boom gate that's our old clunking coal-fired power stations. And so until we get those out of the system and replaced with cleaner technologies, then we're going to be stuck.
The environmental sector also wants the government to provide certainty about the future of the Australian Renewable Energy Agency, the body charged with developing new technologies and increasing the supply of renewable energy in Australia.
Michael Edwards with that report. With innovation the new buzzword after yesterday's statement, much of the focus is on bankrolling startup companies, commercialising their products and then keeping the skills and intellectual property on home soil. But already, the changes gripping the world through digital disruption are being felt close at home by regular consumers. Uber has rocked the taxi industry, just as Airbnb has challenged hotels. Now the insurance industry is having to change with the times and more savvy customers. Zia Zaman, Chief Innovation Officer for the insurance giant MetLife Asia, is speaking with our business editor, Peter Ryan.
Insurance is ripe for disruption. We're modernizing the way we think about insurance by putting the customer at the heart of all of our innovations. Whereas in the past, insurance was really about providing a death benefit to a spouse or a loved one at the end of one's life, we're actively looking at ways in which we can make life and health insurance a more active part of an individual's life by actually extending their life, making it fuller or richer to help them lead longer, thicker lives.
At the moment, a lot of people leave their life insurance policies or their superannuation documents in a filing cabinet or at the bottom of a drawer and don't think too much about it. But is that changing with the greater information that people now have at their fingertips?
We as an industry have to change our thinking to be more innovative, whether it's mental health, whether it's resilience, managing a chronic disease. These are the kinds of things that might give that policyholder a reason to say, hey, help me now, and think about what other things I can get out of my super or my insurance company.
Now, insurance is all about managing risk, but what you're looking at, is it in the future or now that it's going to be about modifying behavior? What are some of the examples there?
First is simply awareness. Making people aware of some of the choices that they make with regards to their health can help prevent or even avoid lifestyle diseases. You mentioned behavior modification, and it was a big pharma executive who actually told me that his next big blockbuster drug will have less of an impact on health outcomes than the next great behavior modification program.
Are you also talking about things like smoking that would be behavior modification, because that's been a very big issue in the type of premiums that people have to pay?
We aren't really targeting smokers at this point. What we really want to do is to find pools of individuals who may have specific conditions, either genetically or due to some other chronic disease, and find a way for them to manage their condition, whether it's managing their stress, their high blood pressure, their glucose count, and making them more insurable, making them a lower risk factor. I say it's the difference, Peter, between the old way of doing it, which was pooling risk, putting risk all on table, slicing it up and selling it, versus sublimating risk, making something hard go away.
Given the digital disruption that we've seen with taxis on Uber, Airbnb for accommodation, is this a matter of survival for the traditional insurance industry?
There is always disruption around the corner in every industry in which I've worked, and do believe that software is eating the world. But in the insurance industry, I think if we can figure out ways to be more intelligent about pricing risk, then that could become a revolution in insurance. We can disrupt or be disrupted, I say.
Zia Zaman, Chief Innovation Officer for the insurance giant MetLife Asia, and he was speaking with our business editor, Peter Bryan. This is AM Around Australia, where it's 21 minutes past 7. President Barack Obama's political opponents have heaped scorn on his address from the Oval Office about the threat of terrorism. Republicans say it revealed no new strategy, no solutions, and said it would do nothing to assuage the fears of Americans. North America correspondent Michael Vincent reports.
Before the president began, Donald Trump was mocking the podium as looking odd. As he finished, Mr. Trump tweeted, "Is that all there is? We need a new president fast." The most powerful Republican in Congress, Speaker Paul Ryan, tweeted, "It was disappointing that there was no new plan, just a half-hearted attempt to defend and distract from a failing policy." Ted Cruz, now the number one Republican presidential candidate in Iowa, ridiculed the president's rhetoric.
"Look, you got the president of the United States standing up saying the Islamic State isn't Islamic. That's not kind of, an interesting view on foreign policy we can have a discussion about. Listen, there's a reason they don't call it the Presbyterian state." It's just nutty.
Another candidate, former governor of Arkansas, Mike Huckabee, also mocked the speech.
"It was a speech about nothing. It was almost like a Jerry Seinfeld episode. There was nothing there that he said that he hadn't said before. He basically said, let's get rid of your guns, all of you law-abiding people. And by the way, don't be so mean to the Muslims."
Most Republicans were angered by the president's link between terrorism and gun control. Among them, presidential candidate Senator Rand Paul, who says the terrorist watch list simply isn't fair.
"Nobody wants somebody who's a terrorist to have a gun, myself included. But there has to be a process. And one of the reasons there has to be a process is, you know, Ted Kennedy was on the watch list. So was Cat Stevens. It was a mistake. But would you want to take away their constitutional rights over a mistake?"
But today, the Secretary of Homeland Security, Jay Johnson, defended the idea that machine guns shouldn't be in the hands of people whose security forces have deemed a threat.
"As a matter of common sense, as the president said last night, if somebody's on a no-fly list, why should it be the case that they're not allowed to fly, but they can still buy a gun?"
It's been noted that after the September 11 attacks, there was a greater sense of unity around the president on the issue of national security. That's not the case now after the worst terrorist attack since 9/11. The White House says there's been a willingness from some Republican presidential candidates to use divisive rhetoric. Spokesman Josh Earnest.
"They have done that, I think, in rather cynical fashion, understanding that it runs contrary to the values of our country, but also understanding that the intensity of some of those emotions could propel their political campaigns."
There are genuine concerns held by both sides of politics about potential terrorists trying to get into the United States. Today, Republican Chairman of the Homeland Security Committee, Mike McCaul, says there have been attempts to exploit the Syrian refugee program.
"Individuals tied to terrorist groups in Syria have already attempted to gain access to our country through the U.S. refugee program."
Today in San Bernardino, California, survivors of the attack plan to return to their offices at the Inland Resource Center. Janice Rutherford is the local district supervisor.
"We stand with them to tell the terrorists, you may not have our fear, you may not have our liberty, and you may not have our love."
San Bernardino County says it is providing a higher level of security for the returning workers. This is Michael Vincent in Washington for AM.
Yesterday marked the 40th anniversary of Indonesia's most significant conflict, its invasion of East Timor. But this anniversary of a controversial war has gone almost unmarked in Indonesia, except for a small commemoration at the headquarters of the nation's special forces, Kopassus. Foreign journalists were barred from the event, but Indonesia correspondent Adam Harvey was able to file this report.
At a military base in South Jakarta, Indonesia's Special Forces veterans gather to remember their war, the invasion of East Timor. A video presentation shows them as fit young men. They're all in their 60s and 70s now, and some of them can barely walk. They're wearing casual batik shirts and the distinctive red beret of Kopassus. Indonesian government minister Luhut Panjaitan was a Kopassus commando in East Timor. He was the main attraction at yesterday's commemoration. 40 years ago, we went out for operation in East Timor from this building. Of course, there are a lot of memories. More than 100,000 Timorese died in the conflict, which ended only when Indonesia allowed a referendum on independence in 1999. It's still a sensitive topic here. I was made to sit in the Kopassus guardhouse during yesterday's event. Our Indonesian cameraman was allowed in and recorded Luhut Panjaitan being asked what lessons were learned. Good planning, and I think this shows the spirit of Kopassus, which is never give up. It was a controversial war notable for many human rights abuses, but it is remarkable how little discussion of it there is in Indonesia. Rafendi Jamin is the director of the Human Rights Working Group Indonesia. He's one of the few who knows the significance of December 7.
It is not something that is remembered by the general public at all.
Luhut Panjaitan says that he and his fellow commandos thought they were doing the right thing in a global fight against communism. That was the briefing that we received. So when the next day we were blamed, it was politics. I learned that we were blamed for things while we tried our best to carry out our duty. The Australian government made no objection to the invasion.
Really part of the Cold War when the anti-communist regime of Indonesia at the time in 1975.
Yesterday's Kopassus event ended with the Special Forces theme song. With that, the veterans of Indonesia's most controversial war hobbled out of the marquee and back into the daylight. This is Adam Harvey reporting for AM from Jakarta.
Loneliness and a sense of isolation can be crippling for refugees when they're trying to adjust to a new life in Australia. But a group of volunteers has put together what they've called a community kitchen to help. Lindy Kerin went along to one of the events and prepared this report.
An event to bring together refugees and asylum seekers now living across Greater Sydney. Today's theme is Aussie barbecue. There's a game of cricket, some ping pong and bingo. And there's also a visitor introducing people to Australian wildlife, including a green tree frog, a snake and a crocodile.
The third eyelid from the side is clear.
Yeah, it's clear.
It's clear so they can see underwater.
The event is run by Settlement Services International, a support organisation for asylum seekers and refugees.
So we're just cutting up the onions for a coleslaw.
They take over the kitchen at the Auburn Community Centre and work with local chefs to prepare a meal. The CEO of Settlement Services International is Violet Remeliotis.
We thought, well, food is always a good way to bring people together. And we thought, why not get people to cook their own meals and invite celebrity chefs or local chefs to do it? And it's evolved into having, you know, different groups come. We've had the Country Women's Association who came with their tuna bake a la chili, lots of chili and curry added to it.
Among those cooking is Jawad, a young man from Afghanistan.
This is my first time that I'm making this Aussie barbecue.
Jawad arrived in Australia by boat 2 years ago and is waiting for a visa. He regularly volunteers at the community kitchen.
When I came for the first time, so I really enjoy, so I just keep coming every time, because every time I learn new things, new chefs, so I really enjoy that.
Jawad says the community kitchen helps him practice his English and get to know other refugees and asylum seekers.
When I come here, I even can't speak. I start from here, I knew different people, teachers, and I start classes, I learn languages, I meet different people. To be a part of community, you have to come and meet the people in community.
Afghan asylum seeker Jawad, ending Lindy Kerin's report. To finance now, oil has plunged to its lowest level in almost 7 years as the global glut shows no sign of abating. This morning, West Texas Intermediate crude is sharply lower at $37.59 US a barrel. The weaker oil price savaged energy stocks on Wall Street, which is currently down almost 1%. Iron ore is also lower for another day at $38.90 US a tonne. The Australian dollar is lower this morning at 72.63 US cents. That's AM for today. I'm Michael Brissenden. It's 7:30.